place of safety, as referred to in Revelation, the 12th chapter, has been an obsession to many in the Church of God over the last 60 to perhaps 70 years, maybe long before that, I don't know. Well, today we're going to take a closer look at Revelation, the 12th chapter, and see if there's anything that we can learn from it that we may have missed along the way. And we'll examine what it says and review some history that is left out, some history before verse 1, some history after verse 1. We'll review that, and we'll explore the subject of the title, which is Leaving It All Behind. Leaving it all behind. So let's turn over to Revelation 12. We'll begin there. And we'll start out with the beginning of the passage. Verse 1 says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars." Now, we don't have to really speculate as to what this is. The context tells us a lot, but also, if we go back to Genesis, the 37th chapter and verse 9, we see this vision or dream that Joseph had, and he saw the sun and the moon and the 11 stars all bowing down to him. Now, that was not a real exciting thing for his brothers or his father. In fact, his father rebuked him for it and asked the question, "Shall your mother and I and your 11 brothers all bow down to you?" And he rebuked him for it. But that took place later on. And we see here that the expression, the sun, the moon, the 12 stars, represented the nation of Israel, the people of Israel. And the context will tell us that as we go through this. But then it says in verse 2, "Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth." So we move from the beginning of the nation of Israel all the way down to the time of Christ, as we will see as we read more of this. But I'm going to skip that for now, and we'll go someplace else. But we see a lot of history that's left out. We don't know what happened before Israel came into existence, a nation, and all that time from the founding of the nation all the way down to the time of the birth of Christ is all left out. And yet there's much history that is in some ways related to this. There are at least four notable examples, and really more than that, but four notable examples prior to this and following verse 1. Where individuals were told to leave it all behind, to get out of where they were and to go elsewhere and leave their past life behind. And in each of these cases, we notice two common themes, and these themes are very important for us. These are the lessons that we want to draw from them, at least some of the lessons. Number one, they were first chosen by God to leave it all behind. And number two, they had to choose to obey God, choose to walk away from everything that they had in the past. So it was both God's calling and a choice. And when we look at Revelation, the 12th chapter, we're going to see that it really is God's calling and a choice. It's not one or the other. It is both that must be involved. So let's notice these four examples that I have for you today with these two points in mind. Now, these are not obscure situations in the Bible. They are very common. They are well known for anybody who reads the Bible. The first one is found in Genesis, the 6th chapter. And we'll begin in verse 1. It came to pass, Genesis 6, verse 1, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Now, we know this was not angels, as Bullock's Companion Bible suggests and others have felt. Angels do not cohabit with human beings for a lot of reasons, but at any rate, Some people have thought that because they were giants in some cases. But there was something about the way that they were marrying at that time that was not within God's plan or what he intended. We generally think that they were of the line of Seth and the line of Cain. There were two different lines. And of course, one was righteous, the other was not. But by this time, nobody was righteous, hardly except one individual. And so, and then in verse 5 it says, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Now it is interesting because we read in the book of Luke about how the time of Noah is like the time of the end. And when we look at the evilness in our world, we get used to a lot of things. We get used to foul language, not only in movies, but in news and commentary that's there. We get used to innuendo. We get used to a lot of things that we just take for granted, and we think, well, at least it's not this or it's not that. I think I may have mentioned this before, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. It's an interesting book. It has problems. First of all, he's clearly an evolutionist. He sees these things happening from an evolutionary perspective. But what he sees happening is reality. He is seeing what is taking place in our world. He's an educator. And he's seeing a lot of it firsthand as well as studying it. And as he writes here on page 6, Gen Z became the first generation in history to go through puberty with a portal in their pockets that called them away from the people nearby and into an alternative universe that was exciting, addictive, unstable, and, as I will show, unsuitable for children and adolescents. You know, before his death, Dr. Meredith was using that term, an alternate universe. He was using it quite a bit. There were a few articles that had come out. But he wanted to write a booklet on the subject, an alternative universe. And this is what we see happening. He's been dead now since, 2017, 7 years ago, approximately. And we are seeing it in spades today. We are seeing an alternative universe that the world is living in. And it's becoming more and more so with AI. And now they've got these glasses where you can see various things. And it's like you were right there in the mountains or in fighting a dragon or whatever it might be that they have. It's an alternative universe. It's not a real. It's not real. And our summer camps are trying to get our young people, among other things, this is not the reason we started them, but truly we are trying to get them more into reality as opposed to this alternative universe that is unreal. And so with the adventure camp going up into the wilderness there in northeastern Oregon, they're going to be hiking in the mountains there, and the highest pass is about 9,000 feet. I was just talking with Mr. Jonathan Bueno last night, and he had to go out with Mr. Casey, and they were looking at how things were because they had a spring storm here just this last week, and they were concerned about the snow, and there is some snow up there, and they'll have to change their path a little bit. But can you imagine that? Traveling from whatever the level is at the beginning all the way up to 9,000 feet and coming back down and seeing beautiful, spectacular vistas and meadows and mountain streams and lakes. It's a wonderful opportunity. It'll be somewhat difficult, but it's not too difficult for our young people to be able to do it. They'll be able to do it. But nevertheless, it will challenge them and it'll toughen them up. And they'll begin to see what is real in this world as opposed to something through glasses. As Mr. Haidt goes on to say, he says, "My central claim in this book is that these two trends, overprotection in the real world and underprotection in the virtual world, are the major reasons why children born after 1995 became the anxious generation. And there are numerous sources that are beginning to talk about this. I saw something just the other day talking about the very same thing. He says, I describe four foundational harms: sleep deprivation, social deprivation, attention fragmentation, and addiction. And then he focuses first of all on girls and then on boys. He says, I have seen the rising levels of anxiety and device addiction as my students have changed from millennials using flip phones to Gen Z using smartphones. He said, by 1917, it had become clear that the rise of depression and anxiety was happening in many countries to adolescents of all educational levels, social classes, and races. They've done studies in 37 countries in addition to the Anglosphere, which, you know, the United States, Canada, Britain, Australia, etc. But 37 additional countries. And all about 2012 began to see rises in anxiety and depression, in all kinds of confusion among young people, and suicide and the rest. He says, on average, people born in and after 1996 were different psychologically from those who have been born just a few years earlier. Now, this affects young people that are sitting right here. And you don't know any difference because this is just the way it's always been. But you don't realize the forces that are out there that are trying to destroy you. Maybe not intentionally at the beginning. I don't think that was the intent of people with social media. I think they probably had some good intentions, but they made it deliberately addictive, and they really had no idea what the long-term effect of it would be. He says, now as I write in 2023, there's a lot more research, experimental as well as correlational, showing that social media harms adolescents, especially girls going through puberty. I've also discovered while doing the research for this book that the causes of the problems are broader than I had initially thought. It's not just about smartphones and social media. It's about a historic and unprecedented transformation of human childhood. The transformation is affecting boys as much as girls. And then he says, I'll offer many ideas for reforms in part four, all of which aim to reverse the two big mistakes we've made: overprotecting children in the real world, we sometimes call it helicopter parenting, where they need to learn from vast amounts of direct experience, and unprotecting them online, where they are particularly vulnerable during puberty. And he gives these four suggestions, and I want to emphasize this, Brethren, because I think that what happens is that every parent thinks my kid is an exception. My child is an exception. It's not going to happen to him or her. And everybody's doing it, so if I try to take the phone away or I try to keep them from it, then I'm going to be the bad guy. Well, welcome to parenting. Welcome to fatherhood. We are there to protect our children, not only from bad guys out there on the street, but also bad guys out there online. And so his suggestions are no smartphones before high school. Now, I wonder how many parents, even in this room, are willing to make that choice. No smartphones before high school. Number two, no social media before 16. No social media before 16. And then he says phone-free schools. Well, you may not be able to do much about that, although you can, I suppose, visit the school board, and far more unsupervised play and childhood independence. In other words, letting the kids go out there and play, not necessarily supervised in some organized sport, but let them play some sports by themselves. Now, this is the world in which we are living that he is talking about, and as you look at the statistics, you find that from about 2012 onward, the graph just goes off the chart with anxiety, with depression, with cutting, with confusion about what gender someone is or what sex they are. All these things go along as smartphones began to be and social media began to be a part of it, and as well as the helicopter parenting. And, you know, people are afraid to let their children out in the front yard without them being watched over, and I'm, you know, please use wisdom and all of that. But worried about some sort of sexual predator, and yes, they are out there, but there are far more. Most of them are online. That's where most of them are in these days. And you have these influencers that are trying to influence your children in a wrong direction. And I just don't think that we get the message sometimes. I think that as I said, I don't know if it was here, but someplace else, you know, we had Tame the Social Media Monster. Maybe we made a mistake on that because we put kind of a cartoon dragon there. And maybe people just don't take it seriously. But this is deadly serious. And the world in which we live is going in the direction, as it says here, that every intent of the thoughts of the heart of his heart was only evil continually. Girls suffer from depression, anxiety, and so forth because of not being able to match up with what they see online and what others are telling them. You know, when you go through that age, through puberty, we're all a bit confused. I can remember I was confused. I was frustrating. As the hormones begin to stir within you, if you're a guy, sometimes you get so mad you just want to put your fist through the wall. Sometimes they take it out on their buddies. But there are things that are happening there, and if it's influenced in the wrong direction, you can go in a very bad direction because it is a confusing time in life. I was always told this is the best time of your life. I don't believe that. Sorry. It's a great time. It's a wonderful time, but you still have to negotiate it. In every aspect of life, there are difficult times. There are good times and there are bad times. But it's a time of life when we as adults need to help young people negotiate the changes that are taking place in their bodies and in their minds and their aspirations and so forth. With boys, the problem is video games and pornography. The pornography being a substitute for a real person, it's a, what you might say, an alternative or a virtual world. It's not real. And the video games, which so many of our young fellows and even not so young fellows get caught up in, is a substitute for a real job because there are different levels you can rise to, and that kind of satisfies them. But it never satisfies entirely. That's why they have to keep going back, keep going back. It never totally satisfies. And this is what's happening to our young people. Now, this generation is really becoming that generation, if we weren't before, where every intent or the thoughts of our hearts are only evil continually. The movies they see, everything is just degenerating down. And so then you read in verse 11, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. And so God chose one individual by the name of Noah. Noah was a preacher of righteousness. Notice over here in 2 Peter 2. 2 Peter, the second chapter. This is interesting because we don't normally think of Noah in this light. But in 2 Peter 2, beginning in verse 4, it says, "For if God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell," or place of restraint, Tartarus is the original word there, place of restraint, "and deliver them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people," or one of eight, "a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly." Now, that's interesting because he was one of eight, and he was a preacher of righteousness. Do we see any parallel with us? Are we not to be a preacher of righteousness in a world that has gone mad, in a world that is not living in reality, that is living in Satan's alternative universe, a world that is confused, a world that is depressed, filled with anxiety, with evil thoughts continually? Do we not see ourselves as preachers of righteousness, the church, the work of the church, of preaching a warning to the world of what will happen if it does not change, and also of giving the good news of the coming kingdom that we can be a part of. When we think about it, let's just stop and think a little bit here. Noah is 500 years of age. And we read of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, three sons. Now, we make the assumption, I think, I always did, that that's all the children he had. But it doesn't say that's the only children he had. Did he not have daughters? Did he not have other sons? We don't know the answer to that, do we? But we know that he had family, his father, and he must have had uncles and so forth, aunts. His wife had family. And so what they were leaving behind by stepping out and being a preacher of righteousness and offending probably a lot of people, because I don't think that he was real popular. They must have thought he was a bit of a nutcase out there building a boat. We always assume it was in the middle of the desert. I don't know exactly what it was like, but there was timber, so there must have been forest nearby. But nevertheless, wherever it was, he's building this huge boat that's 450 feet long or whatever it was, and three stories and all these rooms. And you know, he must have been ridiculed something awful. But he was willing to leave that all behind. And we don't read of any resistance on his part for doing it. If you listen to Bill Cosby's routine on Noah, it's like he's talking with God, like, what are you asking? It's pretty comical, actually. But it's not necessarily the way it happened. We don't know all that happened. But when Noah left his world behind, because, you see, in order to leave that world behind, he had to build that boat, that ark. He had to do something. First of all, God called him because he was righteous, because he was living different from all the rest of the mankind around him. God called him, but he had to do his part. So it was both, wasn't it? It was God's calling and Noah's action, and that of his at least three sons and his wife. And we just don't know if there were other children that would be left behind. But nevertheless, when he started building that boat, it was in a direction that it was going to go. And he was leaving his world behind, at least in his mind already. In the third chapter of 2 Peter, in verse 6, it says, "By which the world that then existed perished, being flooded with water. But the heavens and the earth, which are now preserved by the same word, are reserved for fire until the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." We are coming to a time when our world, as we know it, as, you know, the foods we eat, everything that's around us, the cosmopolitan world in which we live, all of this is going to perish, and our young people are going to come up in a new world. They say come up. They're going to live on into a new world, just as Noah and his three sons and his wife, eight people, left one world behind. They came up in a very different world when they had nothing like what they had before. It was all destroyed. And our young people sometimes feel like, well, they're missing out on something, and yet they have the opportunity that kids in the world don't have, and that is to escape the things that are going to come upon this world and to live on into a different world and raise their children in a much better world when Christ comes back and the kingdom of God rules on this earth. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty ahead. There's a lot of uncertainty for you and me, but there's also a lot of uncertainty for our young people. And yet, that uncertainty should not stop us from doing the right thing at the right time, because if we do, if we serve God, there's a good outcome that's going to come from it. We face a similar circumstance as Noah. It's a little different, obviously, But our world is going to burn down, and eventually God is going to destroy the surface of this earth and bring about a new heavens and a new earth. But those of us here have been chosen. We've been given an opportunity. We've been chosen, but we too must be willing to leave it all behind. And we leave it all behind in daily decisions. It doesn't just come up to a particular time and say we have to flee or something to get out of town, so to speak. It comes out eventually, but the decisions that you and I make today will determine what we do at that time. The next one that we want to look at is a fellow by the name of Abram. And that's also in Genesis, the 12th chapter. We're familiar with that. We've only gone from chapter 6 now to chapter 12. It says, the Lord had said to Abram, get out of your country from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. Now, to get out of his country, his house, he no doubt thought of his family. He must have loved his family. Most of us do love our families, sometimes more than others. Sometimes we have little tiffs, but family is family, isn't it? And he was told that he had to leave his family. Now, you know, there are a lot of people in this world that are not about to leave family. They just refuse to leave family. I may have given the example here where I knew someone that during the apostasy that took place and worldwide, somebody asked this lady that I had ordained, you know, what are you going to do with all these changes? And she said, I don't know. I'll have to see what my sons do. Sons had gone to Ambassador College, and she was going to base her life not on the scriptures, but on the choices that her sons made. And I've actually heard someone say, well, I just couldn't go to a place of safety because I'd have to stay behind and take care of my children. You know, these are things that really make you wonder at times. Here's Abram, and God says, get out of your country. Leave your family behind. Leave that comfortable home that you have where your wife has put up all the pictures and all the things that make a home. You know, a woman takes a house and she makes it into a home and she makes it her own. And you may have some say in it if you're a man, but, you know, women do most of the decisions on those things, and it's probably a good thing. I give my wife plenty of freedom on that. She'll do a better job than I will because I won't have many things to hang up or whatever. I'd be a minimalist. Too much work. I don't want to have to dust them. I don't want to take care of all those things. But anyway, a wife in this case, when you think about Sarah had to leave as well, didn't she? And so Abram and Sarah leave their comfortable home and they go to a place where they don't know. It says, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and I will curse him who curses you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now that's a wonderful promise, but from where they were then until that time, actually, they never saw that at that time, the fulfillment of that promise. So Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. So he had a nephew, and he went with him, but obviously other relatives didn't. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Now that's, you know, I know he lived a long time, and maybe their health was a little bit better, but it gets a little bit tough when you get older to sleep on the ground, because notice what it says over in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. We'll begin in verse 8. It says, by faith, this Hebrews 11, verse 8, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. Didn't know where he was going. Now, think about that. You're told you've got to leave everything behind, and you don't know where you're going. that wasn't revealed. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. So, tents. Tents are not always that comfortable. Now, I'm sure that they were a little bit more than, you know, a pup tent, someone would think of today, and he had servants and he had lots of livestock and everything. So I'm sure that there was a very nice tent, but it wasn't exactly the same as the home that he'd come from, and they had to pick up and move it from time to time, and that's a lot of work. Anybody that's moved knows anytime you move, it's a lot of work. So you have to roll up the rugs and take down, you know, pull up the tent pegs and go to someplace else and then find a spot and maybe move a few rocks so that you're not sleeping on them. It was not necessarily like home. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. By faith, Sarah herself also received strength to conceive seed, and she bore a child when she was past the age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. So we don't read as much about Sarah, but there are a number of places we read about Sarah, and we find that she was very respectful of her husband, calling him Lord or Master. Very different from how many wives today treat their husbands. It says, these all died in faith. Or therefore, verse 12, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born as many as the stars of the sky in multitude, innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. But they all died in faith, not having received the promises. So he did all that, but he never saw the reward during his physical life. Yes, he did see a child born in Isaac, but nevertheless, he didn't see the multitudes and all the families of the earth. He just saw a little teeny tiny part of the earth. But having seen them afar off, in other words, in his own mind, he could see the promises that God had made, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. In other words, they didn't look back. They looked forward instead of looking back. Looking back, you could see what you had. Looking forward, you really don't know for sure other than God's promise. But you look forward because God has promised, you believe in God, you know that this all didn't happen by accident here, and we believe the word of God. And we trust that God is going to take us to some place that is far better, a far better world. So therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. So God has a great reward, but we have to trust him. This is why it's called the faith chapter. We have to have faith in God. And not only did Abraham have faith, but Sarah did as well. And both of them obeyed God's call. God had to call them. He called him to this great blessing. And he did so because of Abram's way of life. But nevertheless, Abram then had to make that move when God said, get out. He still had to do it. And how many people under the same circumstances would not? In fact, we don't know. Maybe God called somebody else before that. I don't think so, but maybe he did. We just don't know. We can also go back to Genesis, the 13th chapter. And we find here that Abram and Lot had become very prosperous. And so the herdsmen of Lot and the herdsmen of Abram were having difficulties. Verse 7, Genesis 13, verse 7, and there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So the Canaanites and the Perizzites then dwelt in the land. So they're living in a foreign land here. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we're brethren, we're kin, we're family. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, then I'll go to the left. Now, Abram is the older of the two, and he's the one that God is working with, and he could say, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go here. You go that way. But no, Abram was willing to give his nephew first choice. He was willing to give him the choice. So Lot lifted up his eyes, and he saw the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord, destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar. Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. So he looked at what looked good. And, you know, brethren, some of the things of this world do look good, don't they? It's so addictive. Movies, you know, bright lights and different things like that. There are certain things that look good on the surface. These smartphones, they can do a lot of good things, and we use them to preach the gospel. But there's so much junk out there. But all this seems so attractive. The problem is that there's a downside to it all, and unless we exercise character and God's help, we can become addicted to these things, and they can destroy us. So Lot chose the plain for himself, the plain of Jordan. And Abram, verse 12, dwelt in the land of Canaan. And Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. But the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Eternal. Isn't that so true? You know, some of those beautiful places on the face of the earth are given over to wickedness. San Francisco is a beautiful city, one of the most spectacular cities in the world. It's not always so pretty right now because of, did you see that they had a debate the other day with the candidates for mayor? And one of the candidates, a woman was standing up, and she was talking to one of her opponents. She said, "How many drag queens do you know the name of?" This is serious stuff. She was chiding the opponent because he or she, I don't know which one it was, did not know the name or could not name a certain number of drag queens or LGBTQ people or whatever that was there. But specifically drag queens, she asked about that. That is where San Francisco has sunk, to where running for mayor, you've got to know the names of drag queens, apparently, at least in the eyes of one of the candidates. Now, Lot dwelt in Sodom, and I'm sure that there were reasons why he liked Sodom and why his wife liked it. And so we come to, he made that choice. And then in chapter 18, we find that these angels, and one being the one who became Jesus Christ, apparently, came to Abraham, and there were certain promises given there, but they revealed to him that they were going to destroy, or they were going to check out Sodom and that area. And so Abraham gets into this dispute, not dispute, that's the wrong word, he gets into a discussion, a bargaining, that, you know, you are the Lord or the judge of all the earth. Would you destroy the city if there were 50 righteous people in it? Well, what about 40? What about 30? What about 20? And he comes down to 10. And he stops. And when you look at it, that may have been in his thinking that that's his most immediate family. Because you had Mr. and Mrs. Lot, I guess for lack of a better way of saying it. And we know they had two daughters, that's four. Two virgin daughters. But they were to go outside of the house, he was told to go out, and to check with his sons-in-law. Now it's nighttime, so the indication is that they lived elsewhere. And some people have tried to say, well, no, it was just these were engaged to his daughters. There's no indication of that. I don't know why that's so hard for people to accept. But if he had a couple sons-in-laws and daughters, and daughters that were married to them, that's another four, and maybe a child or two, that could be 10. But this was something that Abraham was concerned about. If there are even 10 righteous, will you destroy the city? So then we come to the 19th chapter of the destruction of Sodom. And so before they lay down at night, these perverted men come and they want to know these strangers. And I think that all of us who are adults understand what he's talking about there. It wasn't, hello, I'm Jim. You know, you're John. No, it was, as it's used there, have certain relations with them which are inappropriate. And so, to show you just how far Lot had been corrupted by the society in which he lived, yet he's still called righteous, he said, no, don't do this to these men. They have come under the protection of my house. And it was very important in that age that if someone came into your house, you are to protect them. And so he offers his daughters to go with these perverted people. Now, we don't know whether it was a bluff. We don't know exactly all the thinking that was going on there. But I'll tell you what, if I had a daughter, do you think I'd want to send her out to these individuals? The world becomes so corrupt that even the most diabolical thing sounds normal. Abortion. I'm sure there are people in the church that think, well, abortion isn't all that bad. There are other things that we just take for granted. We're like the frog that is boiled. That's actually a myth, I think. But a better analogy would be like, you know, leaven. A little leaven leavens the whole lump. And we become so corrupted by it all. So eventually, we come down to verse 15. He told them to go out and check and see if their son-in-law. But, well, let's just notice that, verse 14. Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters. So these are not the ones that his virgin daughters that are in the house. These are others. And said, get up. Get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. You can't be real. God isn't going to destroy this place. What's the matter with you? What you been drinking? When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. So they're urging them. And while he lingered, verse 16, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. This is not the impression you get of Abram or of Noah. Here is someone who had been so influenced by the world around him, not just influenced by the world around him, but so stuck on what they had that they couldn't imagine leaving it all behind. You can imagine what it was like for Mrs. Lot, especially if she had other children and even grandchildren in the city, along with all of her pictures that she'd hung in her house and, you know, all the pots and pans and all that sort of thing, because they didn't have, there's no indication that they took anything with them, at least not much, anything that they could run with. So he says that he lingered. Verse 16, they took him by the hands, they brought him out and set him outside the city. And it came to pass, verse 17, when they had brought them outside, that he said, escape for your life. Run, save yourself, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. But notice verse 18, then Lot said to them, instead of taking off and running immediately, he wants to engage him in a conversation and negotiate where he could go. He says, please, no, my lords, indeed now your servant has found favor in your sight and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains lest some evil overtake me and I die. I'm a city man. I'm not a country man. Not any longer. He had been, but not anymore. He had gotten older, and I think that as we get older, we recognize that when we're young, we might be, you know, going out in the woods and hiking around. We might go on adventure trips. But as we get older, we finally say, you know, that's not for me. I would love to go on one of those adventure trips. But at the moment, I'm not quite that stupid. I have to be realistic. My knees aren't what they once were. And although I've never twisted my ankle, there's a first time. And I could become a burden to everybody there. Besides that, I don't really enjoy sleeping on the ground anymore. I've done it a few times. Spent a whole summer on the ground, sleeping in a tent. But, you know, at some point you have to say, well, this is not me. And that's where Lot was. Lot said, you know, I can't go to the mountains. I don't know how to take care of myself there. There's wild beasts up there and so forth. And so notice what he says. Verse 20, see now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live? It's just a little city. It's not big like Sodom or Gomorrah where it's so evil and corrupt. It's just a little city. You know, I sometimes I can't remember which stories I've told and which I haven't. I guess that's a sign of age. So please bear with me if you've heard this one before. But when I lived in Michigan, I learned something there, and that was that the concept that a small town is more righteous than a big one is not necessarily so. A big one has more unrighteousness in it, more corruption in it, you might say. But when it comes to raising children, a small town is not always the best place to be. It might be a good place to be, but it might not. Because what I noticed is that the kids who attended the schools in Saginaw, which was, you know, a medium-sized city, not Charlotte, but it was, 200,000, whatever it was. It had a pretty good-sized high school. When you go to a high school where you have 1,000 or 1,500 students, you will find your peer group. It's amazing how young people can spot their peer group almost instantly at camp. If you've got some person who is going to be a little bit on the edge of things, he'll find that other person within the first 15 minutes, it seems like. It's probably a little exaggeration, but not much. First day, they're attracted to each other, and there they are. They're the best of friends. In a high school, if you have a son or a daughter who has good values right now, they'll probably find other kids that are not in the church, but other kids who have a good upbringing, whose parents have certain values, and maybe they're good students, and they live a basically moral life. They'll find them. They'll find their peer group. But if you are in a small town where you have a very small class, maybe 20 or 30 in the class, or even less. I know somebody that grew up in a small town where they had about a dozen kids, and half of them were relatives, and the other half were girls or whatever. It's a very small choice of friends there. If that school is going in the wrong direction, if those kids are going in the wrong direction, there is no place to hide. And I saw that. I was there 9 years and just observed that. And most of the kids who lived in the more rural areas didn't do nearly as well as some that lived in the bigger school areas. Another idea that crime is in the big city, well, one of the highest crime rates is up around West Branch and Rose City area, at least at that time, because people have weekend cabins. And the local kids and others break in during the week when there's nobody there. It wasn't violent crime, but it was crime nevertheless. So just because it's a small town doesn't mean it's going to be the kind that you want to be in. And yet small town life, I think generally we think of it as being better, but not necessarily so. So he says, it's a little one, isn't it? My soul shall live. Obviously, he had that concept in his mind. Verse 21, and he said to him, see, I have favored you concerning this thing also, in that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. And then when he got there, he decided maybe this is not the place to be. And so Lot was a little bit confused by that, and he made some terrible mistakes. But God calls him Righteous Lot, and he delivered Lot from the world of the ungodly. Lot was chosen to escape disaster in spite of his shortcomings. But some of his family were not willing to leave it all behind, and they were left behind and destroyed. His daughters and son-in-laws and grandchildren that might have been there would not leave it behind, so they were left behind for disaster. And then, of course, we read about his wife, that she turned around and became a pillar of salt. Now, some people say, well, I don't know about that, pillar of salt. Could that really be? Well, God who made us, who made all the elements of the universe, he could certainly do that. I think it was literally a pillar of salt, but if we just want to say it, it's metaphorically, I guess that's up to you. But I think it probably was a real pillar of salt. The last one is the Exodus, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. But here was a group of people, a large group of people, the nation of Israel. And they wanted to escape from slavery. They wanted freedom. They longed for freedom. But the road ahead of them was filled with uncertainty. They didn't know exactly where they were going. They had a general idea, I'm sure. But they didn't know exactly how they would get there other than on foot. And there was a lot of uncertainty when it came to food and water and things like that. And they panicked every time something didn't seem to be working out as they would think on their time schedule. And so in Numbers, the 11th chapter, we see that they griped and they grumbled and they complained. And they looked back for the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, and the fish. So, in other words, back in Egypt, they did have some good things. It wasn't all as bad as they thought it was. But, of course, that's the way it is. We always remember where we came from as being better than where we are, at least for a time. Having moved around a lot, my father being in the military, I noticed that you have somebody move into the area and all they can talk about is where they came from. We're all guilty of it. But that was a wonderful place, and where they are right now is not so good. But then they move again, and you run into them in the next place, and the place they just left that they were bad-mouthing before, well, that's the most wonderful place in the world, and where they are now is not so good. That's the way it is. Sometimes those experiences teach us a lot of lessons. And they can teach us a lot about ourselves as well as others. But Israel turned back in their minds. Yes, they wanted freedom, but once they got out, they turned back in their minds. And in 1 Corinthians 10, it says, all these things happened to us as examples. Now let's go back to Revelation 12. Let's get back where we started. Because Revelation 12 is about leaving it all behind, you might say. That's one of the themes of it. We read there in verse 2, being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain to give birth. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads. Now, we know that the fiery red dragon is the great dragon is Satan because of verse 9. It will tell us that. But he worked through this Roman system, this beast system. He worked through it. And it says that his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as it was born. A reference to how Herod wanted to destroy the child, a Christ child, as soon as it was born. But it says she bore a male child. In other words, this child came from Israel, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to God and his throne. So the resurrection that took place there. We've covered in 5 verses a tremendous amount of territory when you think about it. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God that they should feed her there 1,260 days. Now, beginning in verse 6, we change from physical Israel to spiritual Israel, because this is after Christ's coming. And we will see that later in the chapter, it very clearly is talking about the church, the spiritual Israel, not the physical Israel. But she goes into the wilderness for 1,260 days. We take the day for a year principle, and from the time of the 4th century onward, 1,260 years, the church basically had to hide out. And I would imagine that there were many times when the authorities would come into town and when the people of God had to get out of town, just pick up and leave everything behind. But then in verse 7, war broke out in heaven, and Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels, but they did not prevail, nor was a place found for them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the world, and he was cast to the earth and his angels with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, "Now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren who accused them before our God day and night has been cast down." So this is right at the very end that this takes place, just before the end, just before the tribulation begins. And he says, "To rejoice the heavens, but woe to the inhabitants of the earth and the sea. For the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time." Verse 13, "Now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, what did he do? He persecutes the woman." That's you and me. That is the church. He's going to persecute the church. And we don't know exactly what form it's going to come in, but it's going to be a very difficult time. But then it says, "But the woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent for that 3.5-year period. During tribulation on the day of the Lord, she is protected for that time." And when it says fly with the wings of an eagle, they came out of Egypt on wings of an eagle, so it doesn't mean that they go by planes or... It's certainly not talking about a rapture. Because when the woman flees from the presence of the serpent, verse 15, "The serpent spews water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman." So there's going to be some event where God intervenes. The earth is going to help the woman. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood, either an army or literal waters, which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman and went to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's not the Jews. It's not physical Israel. That's spiritual Israel. And God is going to protect certain ones, but there are going to be others that for whatever reason do not go. They are left behind. And that's where the wrath of Satan is going to really fall upon them. 2 different groups. Now, we could go to Revelation 3, and I'm not going to take the time for it, but we read of the Philadelphia group that God says he's going to keep them from the hour of trial that's going to come upon the whole earth. But the next group, Laodiceans, are going to be spewed out of Christ's mouth, because they are lukewarm. We have a booklet on the subject, God's Church Through the Ages. I hope that you'll review that from time to time, showing that these aren't just 7 churches in Asia Minor in the first century, but it's talking about the church down through history. And we're living right now during the age of Laodicea. We hope that we are not Laodicean, but I would hope that everybody who has God's Spirit would hope that they're not Laodicean and try to do something not to be, but nevertheless, we have those who are doing the work of God and those who are lukewarm. They're going to be spewed out of his mouth. So there's coming a time at the end of the age when some servants of God will be given the same choice that we've been reading about, that is to leave it all behind or to be left behind for the consequences that are going to occur. Now, here's some things to consider. Over in Ezekiel, the fifth chapter, Ezekiel 5, we used to talk about this a bit. The fourth chapter talks about him portraying the city of Jerusalem and, you know, in the dirt, the ground, like a child's play of an army attacking another army, or in this case, a city, and the city is Jerusalem. And that was going to be fulfilled in a few years from this time when he does this. But he says in the latter part of verse 3, this will be a sign to the house of Israel. Not to the Jews, but it's a sign of what happened to Jerusalem is a sign to the house of Israel. And in the verses that follow, verses 4 and 5, we see that he knew the difference between the house of Israel and the house of Judah, because the house of Israel was to be describing punishment because of activities for 390 days, but the house of Judah for a period of 40 days. So he knew the difference between the two. And so this was to be a sign to the house of Israel. Then we get to chapter 5. He tells him to take a sharp razor, and he is to shave his head and his beard, and he's divided up into three parts. In verse 2, you shall burn with fire one-third in the midst of the city when the days of the siege are finished. Then you shall take one-third and strike around it with a sword, and one-third you shall scatter to the wind. And I'll draw a sword after it. This is referred to down in verse 12. One-third of you shall die of the pestilence and be consumed with famine in your midst. One-third shall fall by the sword all around you, and I will scatter another third to the winds, and I will draw a sword out after them. But let's go back to verse 3. This last third that's going to be scattered, he says, you shall also take a small number of them. Divide up the hair there and take a little small number of the hairs that are in that last third, and you shall bind them in the edge of your garment. It's kind of like protection. Now, this is somewhat speculative, but it's what we have, I think, generally believed for many years, at least what we talked about years ago. I haven't heard it spoken of for quite a while. But he's to take them, of those that are scattered, he's to take some of them and protect them in his skirt. But notice verse 4, then take some of them again and throw them into the midst of the fire, and burn them in the fire. From there a fire will go out into all the house of Israel. Now what we have always speculated was that it's talking about those that are going to be protected, those that go to a place of safety out of, you know, the ones that are scattered and so forth. But of those, some of them will be thrown back into the fire. In other words, just getting to a place of safety doesn't mean you have it made. Just like Israel, they came out of Egypt, but they didn't come out mentally. Lot's wife got out of the city, but she turned back. And so when we start thinking about a place of safety, we need to be very careful and recognize that this is not going to be so easy. God, first of all, has to call. It's not something that you can just decide, well, I'm going to go to a place of safety. I see tribulation coming. No, there's going to be something that separates those that God calls and those that he doesn't call for that purpose. But secondarily, we have to then make that move. A number of scriptures that we could turn to in the New Testament about how we've got to put everything on the line. But let's just notice over in Luke, the 21st chapter, and I'll try to wrap it up here, Luke 21. As I've said, there are two factors that determine who goes to a place of safety. The first one is God's calling, and that's seen here in Luke 21, verse 36. He says, "Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man." So watch and pray and live your life in a way that God will count you worthy to escape. So it's God's choice on that. If we are to pray about that, and not just pray just to save our skin, but to grow and overcome and to stand before the Son of Man, we need to be praying, but we need to be studying. We need to be living this way of life. But God is the one that ultimately will determine who is protected and who is not. And then the second criteria is found in Luke, the 17th chapter. And he talks first of all about Noah, and as it was in the days of Noah. Then in verse 28, "Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house." This is no doubt those people who are in the area of Israel today. Said, "Don't go back and take those things. Likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not return back." And then we have this chilling warning: remember Lot's wife. Remember Lot's wife. This is a subject that we ought to consider as we approach the end of mankind's rule on the earth. We're not there yet, to the very end. But when you look at the world in which we live, we're getting there very quickly. At some point in the future, a test will come for the people of God in which they, or we, hopefully, we, may be invited to make a momentous decision. That decision is to leave it all behind. Because God will spare those individuals, and we just know that it's going to be far better if you're in that group. But is this not the decision that we face daily? Are we willing to put God and Christ before all else on a daily basis? Are we willing to leave this world behind, or are we going to hang on to it? And what part of it is it that we want to hang on to? The greatest predictor of future behavior is current behavior. And if the past provides a lesson for us, some will leave it all behind, while others will be left behind.